Hi, I'm Hannah Baba, host of Cross Currents. We are 70% listener-supported radio, and just a few times a year, we ask for your support. Now is the time to do that. It's our membership campaign. And for me, one of the things I love about KALW is how it connects me to the world through programming from the BBC, the CBC, and other international stations. If you feel the same, if you feel that connection, make your contribution today. It's easy. Go to KALW.org, click donate. Thank you.
KALW.
This is not a pretty story to tell. People who are trying to build the state are not going to bring out the skeletons and tell the story of their own inhumanity to man.
When we think of slavery, maybe what comes to mind is the American South, but California has a history of enslavement too. So why isn't it better known?
So the history has been erased from the school books. People who live in California who were raised and educated here do not learn this history.
We'll hear a story from 1850s California. Then a dancer from Fairfield shares her experience of competing on the reality show Lizzo's Watch Out for the Big Girls.
It's such a cool environment. I've never been in a room with a bunch of other women who have been through the same struggles.
That's coming up. I'm Hannah Baba, and this is Cross Currents. Sunday was Juneteenth, the holiday that commemorates the emancipation of enslaved people in America. And when people think about the institution of slavery, many people may think of the American South. But California also has a history of enslavement. The podcast Gold Chains digs into that history. It's a production of the ACLU of Northern California, and it's produced and hosted by Tamerlan Drummond. Today, we'll hear a story from that podcast about a group of men enslaved by a man named Charles Perkins.
It's a cool spring night in 1852. Carter Perkins, Robert Perkins, and Sandy Jones, three formerly enslaved black men, are asleep in a cabin. All of a sudden, the front door busts open. It's the county sheriff, and he's with a posse of white men. They rouse the startled men from their beds at gunpoint. They tie them up, steal $2,000 worth of gold dust, cash, and other property from them. That's about $65,000 today. Then they throw the men into their own wagon and use their own team of mules to whisk them away in the dead of night.
The goal here was to make sure that none of the men's friends or neighbors knew what was going on. They would just be gone in the morning.
Just imagine. The men have no idea where they're being taken, and after a terrifying ride, they find themselves in front of a justice of the peace. He declares them fugitive slaves and orders them sent back to a slaveholder on a Mississippi plantation who had filed a legal claim saying that they were his property. Now, this might sound like some nightmare story out of the pre-Civil War South, but it's actually not. It happened right here in the supposedly free state of California. How was this possible in a free state? Stacy Smith breaks it down for us.
So California is really a pretty wide open place after the United States takes it from Mexico in the 1840s. And so what really happens is that hundreds of thousands of people, they rush into California for the gold discoveries. There's no organized territorial government. Law enforcement and judicial structures, well, they're not non-existent, but they aren't especially strong. They're just kind of thrown together. And it's kind of this last minute affair. So I'd say that there's a gap of almost 2 years, maybe about a year and a half, where there isn't a constitution in force. California isn't a state, it's not even a territory. And that gives enough time, because it's, you know, really that same period is the height of the gold rush migration. It gives enough time and enough motivation for slaveholding white Southerners to move in with enslaved people. And they go into the mines, they spread out, and they begin to work digging gold.
Charles Perkins was one of them. He was the young son of a wealthy Mississippi plantation owner, and in the summer of 1849, decided to join the mass migration of gold rushers going west. He took an enslaved man from his father's plantation with him. We really don't know much about Carter Perkins. He was about 21 years old and most likely had worked in the fields picking cotton. The two men probably had the same last name because enslaved people often took or were given the surnames of the plantation owner. Once in California, Charles Perkins headed for El Dorado County and put Carter Perkins to work digging for gold. It was exhausting work, and some miners died from diseases like scarlet fever and cholera. After a short time, some of Charles Perkins' friends brought two more enslaved men from the Perkins plantation to California to mine gold. The new arrivals, Robert Perkins and Sandy Jones, were older, middle-aged men with families. Robert Perkins had a wife and five children that he'd had to leave behind. After about a year and a half, Charles Perkins decided to go back home to Mississippi. For some reason, though, he decided to leave the three enslaved men behind, perhaps because he couldn't afford to pay their way back. So he hired them out to a neighbor named Dr. Hill. The two white men made them an informal deal. If they worked for Dr. Hill for six more months, he would set them free. So Charles Perkins tells Dr. Hill,
"So you watch over these enslaved men, and once they've performed a certain amount of labor for you, go ahead and set them free." Or at least that's how Hill, Dr. Hill, who is this friend of Charles Perkins, interpreted what he was supposed to do.
6 months later, Dr. Hill set the men free. But as Stacy Smith explains, there's a problem.
Well, it's not clear that they got any freedom papers. So freedom papers are basically these legal documents that you draw up before a judge, and it says on the paper that here's my proof that I'm free. And then you probably get a white witness or two who testifies, yes, I know that this is a free person. But as far as we know, the enslaved men in this case probably didn't get those papers drawn up. Or if they did, the papers were lost or stolen. And, you know, I think it's a pretty good assumption that if they did have these freedom papers, the men who raided their cabin in the middle of the night probably took them and kept them out of the process later on.
What must it have been like for three grown men who had been enslaved their whole lives to finally taste freedom? Carter Perkins was still a young man, but Robert Perkins was 42, and Sandy Jones was 57. They had spent many years in bondage, but for the first time, they are their own masters. And according to Stacy Smith, they don't waste any time.
So they eventually buy a team of mules and a wagon, and they become quite successful. They're hauling goods back and forth among all of these gold mining towns. And all of the men, except for Carter Perkins, who was the youngest, were family men. They were middle-aged men who, as far as we know, had children and families back on the Perkins plantation in Mississippi. So there's been a lot of speculation that they were trying to earn enough money as quickly as they could to buy their family members and bring them back out to California, or at least to be able to go back to the East Coast and perhaps buy the freedom of their family members and settle elsewhere.
Little did they know that pro-slavery Democrats in the California legislature were planning to unleash racial terror on black people in the state. California entered the Union as a free state under the Compromise of 1850. The new Constitution had a clause: neither slavery nor involuntary servitude, unless for the punishment of crimes, shall ever be tolerated in this state. So what did this mean for enslaved black people who had been brought to California before statehood? Were they now automatically free?
Enslaved people who were brought into the state in 1848 or 1849, you know, by the time, you know, statehood arrived in 1850, they would find themselves in the California hills. It was very remote. They were able to run away in the hills and find sanctuary with other free African Americans or with abolitionists and allies. So this definitely caused a problem for those enslavers.
That's Taylor Bythewood Porter with the California African American Museum in Los Angeles. Bythewood Porter says that as more and more formerly enslaved black people started running away, slaveholders became increasingly agitated. There was a federal fugitive slave law that required government authorities and private citizens to help slave owners recapture formerly enslaved people who had fled to free states. But that didn't help California slaveholders, That's because black people who escaped in California didn't cross any state lines. Their enslavers had voluntarily brought them here.
When enslaved people started to bring their court cases to try to fight for their freedom, the law definitely favored those who were enslaved at that moment in time, especially if they didn't cross any state lines. In the eyes of the law, they were free. And so this really aggravated a lot of the Southern Democrats and politicians.
Now, at this time, about a third of the white people living in California were from Southern slaveholding states. And a surprising number of them got elected to public office. They were mayors, local sheriffs and judges, state lawmakers, and U.S. senators. They had a lock on the state Supreme Court. Southern slaveholders and their allies wielded the full force of their political power to fight for a foothold for slavery. And so on April 15, 1852, the California legislature passed its own fugitive slave law. It gave slaveholders 1 year to collect their enslaved persons and take them back to their home state. Charles Perkins got wind of the new law. He probably also found out from some of his family members still in gold country that Carter Perkins, Robert Perkins, and Sandy Jones had done quite well for themselves. And Taylor Bythe Wood Porter says this is what happened next.
Their former enslaver, who is now in Mississippi, he ended up writing a letter to his cousin, who was still in California in the area at the time, and he told him to come and pick up his people.
And that cousin was part of the posse that broke into the men's cabin, which is where we began our story.
That was an excerpt from the podcast Gold Chains from the ACLU of Northern California, produced and hosted by Tamerlan Drummond, who was also a fellow in KALW's Audio Academy. You can hear the full episode at KALW.org. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. On the reality show Lizzo's Watch Out for the Big Girls, plus-sized female dancers compete to join the singer Lizzo on tour. One of those competitors is Isabel Jones from Fairfield. Isabel grew up listening to K-pop, and she often posts videos of her dancing to it. She's received a lot of love online, but also some hate about her body. But she's not allowing anyone to stop her from doing what she loves. KALW's Janae Darden spoke with Isabel Jones about her experience on the show and how it's changed her self-image.
Isabel, welcome.
Hello.
Ooh, we got a dancer. I'm from Fairfield, represent Fairfield. Shout out to Fairfield.
Come on, 707.
Okay. Glad to have you on. Okay, let's start from the beginning. You've been dancing since you were like in kindergarten.
Oh, yeah. I went to my local hip hop classes at my community center. My mom signed me up when I wanted to go to ballet. But yep, I've been getting into it since I was maybe 4 or 5 years old, and I haven't stopped since.
What was it like? I have to ask, what was it like working with Lizzo?
Oh, insane. So I'm not the reality show type. I don't like getting into arguments. I do not like discrepancies. I'm the person in the back, like, making facial expressions. But this was a really wholesome environment, and Lizzo really wanted to create a safe space for us bigger women to just come forward and be ourselves without having those stringents that society has placed on us all of our lives. And really just working with her has been a dream come true, because she's like the best boss ever. She like truly cares for us and speaks to us like we're human, and we experience smaller versions of what she goes through on a daily life. But she sympathizes with us and understands where we're coming from. And we seek out comfort with each other, which is weird because I'm like, why is Lizzo looking for comfort through me? So it was really such a, it's such a cool environment. I've never had been able to experience that before and been in a room with a bunch of other women who have been through the same struggles and being able to open up those sides of my life that I didn't feel comfortable opening up about before.
And I saw the support and love she gave you all, and she just really wants you all to be better and to shine and to, to take up space. And one episode where you were challenged was a new photo shoot. Mm-hmm. And I know that takes a lot of confidence to do something like that. How did that experience, like, how has that benefited you in the long run?
Well, I mean, it, never in my life did I ever think I'd be posing for anybody nude. But the thing is, it was a nude photo shoot challenge. But if you end up watching the show, for everyone who's listening, sorry, teaser, she was very open in letting us explore that part of ourselves within our comfort zone. So me and another girl, Ariana, we were not okay with posing nude whatsoever or being naked in front of anybody. So we had the option of wearing nude colored bra and undies. And we had a bunch of props. We had a huge drape that we could just cover our entire body if we wanted to. We had plans if we wanted to be a little bit more in tune with nature. But being able to challenge ourselves within our comfort zone and being able to still explore that side of ourselves without feeling maybe uncomfortable with the situation that's been given to us. So me, myself, I was like, ooh, I don't want to be sexy or sultry for anyone. I've been sexualized online and I don't like that feeling and I don't want to give into that. And also just thinking about if I did go full out in this nude photo shoot and how that could infect my other dreams that I may have. But being able to challenge myself within my comfort zone has been really helpful in navigating my life now that's going a different direction.
So how has the show changed how you view your body?
Ooh, that's a hard one. I am not entirely body positive. I stick more to the side of body neutral, where I appreciate my body and how it's able to do the things that it's able to do. I think it's because I grew up being fat phobic. Just because I grew up in an Asian culture where everyone's a size two and I'm scared of how people look at me. And it's hard to go from negative to positive immediately, you know, in a span of a year. So I don't know if I'll get completely to body positivity, but it's definitely has impacted me to go towards that and being less afraid of how people view me. I mean, because every single performance we had on that show, we were wearing leotards.
Right.
And really tight leotards. You could see everything. Mm-hmm. So being able to view that and seeing that I don't have to be so afraid of what I look like I don't look that bad and a leotard with my belly shaking and my arm shaking and my cellulite out. And I'm able to see that. I'm like, oh, okay. I still look kind of cute. It's fine.
Yeah, you look
compared
great.
Compared to being so scared of like, oh my God, if I wear this tight shirt, they might see this one body roll on my side and then they'll say something. So definitely I care significantly less about what people think. I get to wear clothes that I want to wear a lot more than I have in the past. And I hated talking about my body. Even before the show and having a quote-unquote body positive platform, I never talked about my body ever. Didn't like talking about it. Didn't want it to be a topic. I just wanted to be considered to be a dancer, not a plus size dancer. And now I'm able to take that brand, I guess, and put it on me and not be so afraid of how people view me. I am a dancer, but I'm also a plus size dancer and a good one at it too.
Mm-hmm. That was dancer Isabel Jones speaking with KALW's Janae Darden. That interview was produced with help from Porfirio Rangel. You can watch Isabel dance on the Amazon Prime show Lizzo's Watch Out for the Big Girls. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.